Dang it, it's never too late to learn.
Okay, one, two, three.
We're conducting an interview this afternoon at 227 Southern Avenue in Thunder Bay, and it is February 14th, 2012. And I will have our narrator introduce himself and just very briefly state the positions that he's held in mm-hmm. related to the grain industry.
Well, first of all, welcome to my home. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity and privilege to be a part of this. My name is William Harib. I first started in the grain business, per se, in 1975. I was a 26-year-old young man who never thought he would get into this type of business. I didn't know too much about it, except when I was growing up, when I was 7 or 8 years old, I used to sell newspapers on grain ships, in particular foreign ships, because they would give you the most tips. They would give you, you wouldn't have to ask for the dime. They would give you a quarter, what we used to call it, 2 bits in those days. But I remember running over to the Times Journal on May Street, and I used to have a clever way to get there earlier than the other boys, because I had a note from my father that I forged his name, and I fessed up to him years later. But I had him say, "Please excuse Willie." They called me Willie in school, primary school, because he has an appointment with the dentist. Of course, I did that for 4 weeks in a row, and the teacher says, "Well, how many dental appointments are you going to have?" I remember Mrs. Dickerson, her name was in grade three, and she used to let me out at 3 o'clock. Regular school would be out at 3:30. So I'd get out and I'd run like heck to the Times Journal, go in a bag, and buy 20 papers for $1. 4.5 cents a paper at that time. And then run like heck down Victoria Avenue, and sometimes you'd see a few people walking around. You'd say, "Paper, sir, paper, ma'am." It was a lot of business, a lot of stuff happening, especially on a Friday or Thursday. But anyway, I used to sell the papers there, as many as I could, and I used to go over to the Adnac Hotel. There used to be a lot of mariners that used to stay there, especially the pilots. We had, in those days, pilots that would navigate the ocean ships. And they started coming in 1961, and I was about 11 years old. And I knew they were there, and I used to sell 4 or 5 there, 50 cents a piece. And they would tell me where the ships were. And they'd say, "Okay, kid, there's a ship over at Pool 8. Which is the derelict elevator we have at on the Karam River. I said, "Okay, great." So I'd run over there, and I'd have maybe 8 or 10 papers left, and I would sell them to the captain for about 25 cents each. So you could see the profit was really... I've never made more profit in my life since then. But that's when I first got a sense of what grain was, because I noticed grain coming out of an elevator, out of these elevator spouts at Pool 8 there. So, I mean, fast forward, I didn't think too much about the grain business. I did my formidable work on the street selling newspapers, going to the various bars and doing that. We weren't too well off when I was a young boy, and my father didn't have the means to give too much to his boys, gave as much as he could. I have 2 brothers. So this was 1960 range, 61, in that range. And this is when the Keefer Terminal was just developing too, I remember. And we lived in the East End. And we noticed all this activity. And you know, the elevators were there. You had this huge concentration of elevators at the intercity area, and it was always fascinating to see, well, you know, these are huge things. What do they do? And we used to sneak in. We like pigeons. And there's pigeons all over the place. And we were just moving around trying to figure out what these huge buildings do. So it's quite interesting. But anyway...
Did anybody ever stop you?
We were told to get out of there many times. They just told us, the foreman would say, hey, what are you guys doing here? You're not supposed to be here. And they would chase you away. So,
just to go back to your dad, so your father wasn't connected to either the railways or shipping or...
My father was connected with the railway. We came here in 1949. My father and my mother emigrated to Canada at that time. They were from the Ukraine, and they were taken by the German forces in 1941. He was a young man of 19, and he was taken forcibly to Germany when the Germans invaded the Ukraine. My background is Ukrainian. As you can see, my name is different. It's pronounced Hreb in Ukrainian language and Hrib in English language. Anyway, my father was taken away to Germany, and he met my mother, who was taken by the Germans in 1943 as the Soviets were pushing out the Germans in that particular, in 1943, 2 years after my father was there. They took a lot of young people back, and they took my mother. She was only 14 years old, believe it or not, quite a young lady. So they met in 1944, their romance. They had their first, the war ended. They got married in May of 1945, and they had their first child, my brother, Mihail, which is Michael. And they had me in 1948. But a year before that, my father discovered that his father, my grandfather, was living in Fort William. Fort William, of course, before we were amalgamated to Thunder Bay, you had Fort William and you had Port Arthur. My grandfather came here in 1927 to make some money and then ostensibly go back and buy some land or buy a couple of head of cattle or a pull horse or something. They had a little farm, 2 hectare. Farm in the Ukraine. So my grandfather had good intentions, but unfortunately, he was a 33-year-old man at that time, 1927. And 1928, he got a job with Great Lakes. He was there when the first paper machine was developed, in 1927. So it all started then. He was right there, right on the spot. And, they were communicating, and all of a sudden things changed between 1928 and 1932. 1928 was when Stalin took power, and he shifted a lot of Ukrainians all over the place because Ukrainians were really nationalistic, and Stalin didn't like that too much. And he shifted a lot of these people to Kazakhstan, Siberia, just so that this notion of independence... He didn't want that. So some of my grandfather's friends, whose name was William as well, they made the mistake of going back. They were here 2 or 3 years, and a year maybe before my grandfather. And my grandfather got wind that when those guys went back, those people went back, everything was expropriated, just taken away. So my grandfather said, nope, I'm not going to go back. Because he probably had a little bit of a nest egg. And then he decided, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to wait. It's going to change. Well, it never changed. It got worse. You had the big Ukrainian famine, the Holodomor in the Ukraine, where so millions of people were killed, were starved to death. And so they sort of lost touch in a way. There were some letters. And it started to get less and less. And then the war came. Of course, 1939, and my grandfather was firmly entrenched here, and he had friends, and he was quite the character, I understand. He still has a reputation, even though he's been gone since 1983, and I still hear old people in their 80s saying, yeah, I remember your grandfather. He was quite the guy, quite the ladies' man. So we've got that reputation to really think about.
To live up to or live down.
Yeah. I'm not sure which one. So anyway, to make this story a little bit shorter, because I could go on and on. My father wanted to emigrate somewhere. He didn't want to go back to the Ukraine, because in 1948, they were sending a lot of Ukrainians back, who were taken forcibly. My father heard these very, very bad stories, and my father said, no, I don't want to go back, because a lot of these people who did go back were met thinking that, they're going to go back to their own homes. No, they were considered as traitors, really, and they were shifted all over because they worked with the German war effort. And of course, the authorities at that time didn't like that. And so my father wisely says, no. And my mother really wanted to go back bad. She was still a young lady. She was married at 16 and had her first child when she just turned 17. But she missed her mother and her sister. And my father says, no, we have to go. We have to leave. So they went to the Red Cross, and my father discovered that they could print their name in various newspapers throughout North America to see if somebody would find their relative, because you needed a sponsor to go to Canada or the United States. So they were married. I came along, and there was still no news until somebody in Winnipeg picked up the name in one of the big newspapers there in 1940. Early 1948, late 47, saying, "Oh, Harib, that's strange. I know Harib, and chum around with Harib in Fort William when I go there and want to have a great time." So he phones my grandfather. He says, "I think your son is looking for you." My father's own. My grandfather's own. Gee, and I don't think he was. I think he was a bit reluctant because he had his life here and didn't know what to do. The Ukrainian community here got on his back and said, "Hey, listen, you got a son and a couple of young boys," and so he acquiesced and he sent us the money, and we flew here. Actually, he didn't send my father and my mother diligently saved enough to fly, and flying in 1949 was just unheard of. So probably my grandfather gave him some resources, and my father and my mother had some. So we got here in April of 1949. But on the plane, we had to stop in Reykjavik because there was an engine problem, my mother tells me. And we had to wait for this part. We were there 13 days. We could have took a boat quicker. Like the conventional way of an immigrant, right? anyway, we finally got here and got to Montreal and came to Fort William by train, a two-day train ride, and we were greeted by my grandfather.
So your father arrived, I'm assuming, without the ability to speak English?
He did not speak English.
And without a job. So how did he get onto the railway?
He got onto the railway with my grandfather's help. My grandfather, he knew a lot of people, let me retract it. My father wanted to get on with the Great Lakes paper. I'm going to correct this, because this is going to go down in history here. I don't want to be wrong. He tried to get on a job at Great Lakes, but for that particular time, for some reason, my grandfather didn't want to have him there, for some reason. I don't know why. They were fighting. because the moment they got to the train station, they started to fight like cats and dogs, because my grandfather had this woman on his arm with a big fur coat and fancy hat. My father said to him in Ukrainian, "Who is this?" And my grandfather says, "This is my girlfriend." Girlfriend. Well, you know, it just hit the fan right there, because my grandmother was still alive. And then it started. They had this vitriol for years. And this job thing didn't help things too much. So we stayed at my grandfather's place on D Street for a few weeks, because there was no place to go. And then we finally, my father knew some people that he met for several days he was here on the railway, from the railway. He said, "Hey, they're hiring at the coal docks." So my father went to the coal docks. And he got a job. And he got a job as a sectionman. And he worked with Ukrainians, Italians. And there was nobody who spoke English. The foreman was a Ukrainian. So my father really didn't learn to speak English as we do for his entire life. But he was a brilliant man in his own way. If he would have had the education, I'm sure he would have been a real success. He was a real political-minded guy, too, and he just knew everything about... He had instinctive intelligence, you know. But anyway, he worked there and for a while, and then... actually worked there for 22 years.
Now, excuse my ignorance, because I'm assuming that the coal docks unloaded coal. Is that,
yes,
is that exclusively then? So did his job include grain cars at all?
Yes, because he knew a lot of people who worked with the grain door, with the grain car people on the CPR. There used to be a section called grain doors. Grain door. Actually, my father did work with the grain door department when he wasn't doing sectionman work, like a sectionman in those days. Would change track, would change rail, would change ties, bank spikes, clear snow. It was very hard work, very hard work. And it was, when it was slow there, they would put him on the grain door staff, where they would take the grain doors out of the grain car, break them down, and stack them. So I guess that was his first experience with grain.
And those grain doors would be...
The grain doors. There used to be a play at Intercity here. They would convey those cars there, and also at Pool 5, I believe there was a grain door shack there where they would dismantle the as the grain was discharged into the elevator. Of course, in those days, they didn't have the rail cars that we have today that just dump out of the hopper. But they secured their grain with wood, grain doors, they used to call them. And they used to take that, break down the inside of the rail car, and they were coopered to the walls, and... they'd break that down, and there used to be a lot of dust and all that stuff. So he was in the 50s, I suppose. He got into that sort of grain thing. Point to note, too, I remember he was having a problem with his eye. I took him to the Mayo Clinic, and he had this condition called pterygia. Pterygia is a condition where people get that work in the grain business. So... There may have been some sort of effect on his eyes because of this working with the grain.
So do you know anything more about pterygia? How does
pterygia is a condition where there's a
cataract?
It's not a cataract. It's a growth across. If it's not treated, it covers your eye. The other curious thing the doctor told us at the Mayo was that it's a condition that's prevalent in sugar beet countries when they're harvesting sugar beet because it's some dust or whatever. And one of the doctors said, "Have you been in the sugar beet business?" And no, grain business. Yeah, you know. But the condition started, and it just stopped for some reason. It just didn't continue, so there was no reason for an operation. But that could have been because of the grain business. But my father worked in the elevator environment, doing track and things like this, and the grain doors. And
so he was closest to the Empire Elevator then, I guess.
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
Do you have memories of the Empire Elevator?
I sure do. The Empire Elevator was quite the attraction for young boys there because we used to swim in the Cam River. And we used, living in the East End, you didn't have any pools, or you didn't have the parks. You had Dees Pool in those days. That's about it. But from the East End to Dees Pool, it was like millions of miles away. So we used to go and swim at the Cam River, right looking up at this huge, I remember it was a purplish elevator, quite impressive, right in the East End, right in your backyard, trains going in, a lot of noise, and you know, it was an attraction for a young kid who was 6 or 7 years old, and there was the old brick wall there in the East End we used to play at. But no, the Empire Elevator. I'm glad you brought that up. That didn't come to mind until you brought it up. It was quite the place.
Now, given that you were in the East End, I can check out some stories with you to see if you can add to them or deny them. We pick up different stories as we go through these various interviews, and I'm interested in the community involvement with grain elevators in a non-legal way. So, for example, here's stories of people going out in boats and augering into the grain cars and
there was quite a bit of activity. I won't mention the nationality that used to do this, but you could probably a lot of the people. In the East End, there were Ukrainians, Slovaks, Italians. You had this wondrous mix of people, this quintessential melting pot. And during the 50s, resources weren't there, and you had this. People who worked on the railway, and there was a lot of seepage through the doors, and used to have a lot of people with bags, burlap bags, who would go and know when the CPR police would be there, because they would get a pattern, and they'd be clever enough to be at the right spot at the right time to gather up the grain, and in some cases drill into the drill into the rail car, or into the wooden rail car, and have it seep out, and then take off and feed their pigeons or their chickens. We had chickens at home. There was a little farm right back of McPherson Street, I remember. A woman had one cow, and she had a little business selling milk. I remember my mother going there buying milk. I think there was another one who had a goat. it was quite the thing. And we had chickens, and my mother used to go every Sunday, and we had a chicken coop, of course. And my father, fortunately, had Sunday off, and first thing on Sunday we'd go to church. We'd get dressed up. My mother dressed us up, and it'd take us to church, and then later that day, my mother would take us to the, after we got back from church. It was the Church of the Transfiguration, by the way. And church on, and there was four churches. And Sunday was the, in the East End, it was very special because everybody went to church, except some guys from the Italian church who ended up going to the river and were playing craps. They'd leave St. Dominic's Church and meet some of their buddies from the Slovak church and just go to the river and shoot craps. Church would start at 9. I remember we used to go at 9. And as kids, we'd excuse ourselves from our church like mid-mass. Well, Mom, I have to go to the bathroom. So we would escape from church and make a beeline down McIntosh to the river, and we'd look over the brushes, and they'd be playing craps. You know, you'd hear these things like, "Hey, yeah, Mama needs my new shoes, and my baby needs new shoes," and all this stuff, and the wads of money these guys had. There was guys there. I remember guys. Should I mention any names? No, maybe not.
No need to mention names.
No. Okay, but anyway, they used to have a grand time, and we used to watch them, and then most times they would look and say, "Hey, you guys, get out of here," you know. So we'd run back and make the last 2 minutes of Mass. And my mother and father say, "Where are you? Where were you?" "Oh, Mom, you know, it just had to take a bit longer."
Another thing that I'm interested in, just because sometimes my husband, whose family's also from the East End, I'm sure they weren't playing craps though, is the use of grain doors. What kinds of things were grain doors used for other than by the railway?
Well, grain doors were, it had a lot of usage. You could imagine. I mean, this is wood. I mean, a lot of the homes in the East End were made of wood, practically clapboard, and insul brick. You know, insul, you'd have no, I bet there wasn't one house in the East End that was brick, if there was, that was a very rich guy. The priest had a brick house. The local priest had a brick house. Grain doors were there. They could make, first they burned it, you could burn it. There's a lot of potbelly stoves. We had a little house my father bought for $800 when they had my grandfather and my father, when they sort of split. But that didn't last too long. But anyway, they had a big potbelly stove in the middle of the living room. And there was only one bedroom, and I remember my father used to have not only burn coal, but he burned wood, which is dangerous. But sometimes you didn't have the coal, so that was one application for that. Plus, they built things with grain doors: chicken coops, pigeon coops, sidewalks. Remember in those days, you had those big ditches, and people made their own sidewalks to their homes, I suppose, so it wasn't just for grain. It was a practical way to use something and make good of it for your own use, I suppose.
So as we move along then from your father being in the railway business, was that what you initially saw yourself doing?
No, I did not want to get into that business.
Why not?
Well, because I knew it was hard. My father used to come home and he was tired. He didn't have that much time to be with his children. As a section man, they would work 14, 16 hours a day. sometimes. And my father never shirked working the overtime because we had no money. We had, I think my father had 18 cents when he arrived here. And he worked hard. And I very quickly discovered I did not want to do this. There was other ways looking at making a living. So I never even dreamt about it. Although I did work, I took a job on the section gang in 1966 when I was just in my grade 11 summer. I needed a job, and my father got me a job on an extra gang. And I worked the summer there, and I worked. It was hard. It was hard work, and I really appreciated what my father was doing, because we changed ties. He learned how to spike, hit a spike with a big hammer, 16-pound hammer, 25-pound hammer, I forget. But it was hard work. We changed ties, tamping, changed rails. So I had no. I did one summer. I said, there's no way. I had a great tan that summer. You got some muscles. I remember my father. I always admired my father's physique. He was a small guy, you know. He was barely 5'5", but he had a physique that we were just amazed at. When we were kids, we used to run to him. We didn't want to bother him, but we were amazed at how big his arms were, you know. And we'd say, hey, Bob, they won't want to see your arms. Hey, do this, you know. So we had that thing, but yeah, God bless him. He worked hard, but he ended up getting a job at Great Lakes finally, through my grandfather, back in 1966, and he worked his working career to 1986 when he retired from there. So you
moved off into a different direction.
How did you get to, we haven't even talked about what you were doing. Exactly. Well, we'll get to the chase here, because I know you want to talk about grain. And I like to talk, okay.
It's better to interview someone who likes to talk than someone who doesn't.
Anyway, I completed high school in 1967, I always wanted to get into broadcasting, journalism, writing, newspaper work, in particular broadcasting. I loved guys like Foster Hewitt and Danny Gallivan, those guys, those play-by-play announcers. And I wanted to be one of those type of guys. So I took a year off school. 1967, I went to Confederation College and I took a two-year course in communication arts, studied broadcasting. And I completed school in 1971, and I got an offer with a radio station in Williams Lake, British Columbia, back in 1971. Ended up going to Vancouver, and we had a couple of weeks. My buddy and I went to Vancouver. We had a couple of weeks. I had to be up there on the 16th of December. So we left here about the 1st. Well, we never made it because we got caught up in this gas town. Remember gas town Vancouver, the hippie stuff? Well, we got caught up in all that, and I missed the gig. I missed the gig in Williams Lake. My parents were disappointed. I had to phone home, get some money, come home, tail between my legs, you know. And my father says, well, what are you going to do now? Of course, this is all in Ukraine. We spoke in Ukrainian all the time. And my friends who did come over, they were always admired that I could speak two languages, and although they didn't understand, they sat back. They were amazed. But anyway, I had I had this wandering lust, and I loved to travel, and I ended up, I wanted to go to South America and pursue my journalism so-called career. So I ventured to South America in 1974. I went to meet somebody there, never met them, and I was heading to Chile to do a story on the Allende assassination. He was killed in 1973 when there was the revolution. CIA was a part of that. Kissinger, that sort of intrigue, that sort of stuff. Anyway, I ended up in Chile, and the first thing they asked, well, my passport, it had a journalist, periodista, para español. And they said, well, what are you going to be doing in Chile? Naive kid. I said, I'm going to be writing a story about Allende. Oh, Allende? You, yeah? And he said, I said, yes. No, you're not. And they escorted me back under rifle with two guys, said, you know, you're back. They ended up back in Peru, threw me back. Anyway, I spent about 8 months there, and I came back. I had no money. And I wrote a journal, and I was never published, unfortunately, for the stuff I did there. But I came back and met my wife, who is my wife now after 35 years. And in 1970, late 75, or no, 74, just to show Lee's parents that I wasn't just a roustabout or a footloose and fancy free guy that Lee's mother called me several times. Lee says, well, you know what? Hey, you better get a job. So I got a job. I got a job at Lacey's Taxi. I drove a taxi for a while, for a few weeks. And the job came up. Lee spotted the job in the newspaper. It was Lakehead Shipping Company requires water clerk. So Lee said, well, why don't you try this? I said, what's a water clerk? I don't know. He said, well, try, you know, give it a shot. And we had just been going together for about 3 or 4 months, you know.
So what is a water clerk?
Water clerk is a clerk who works for a port agency, who goes to the ships and does documentation in terms of fills out custom papers. Every ship require coming in from, if it's a foreign ship, has to file a customs declaration. So as a water clerk, you're like the runner. You're the runner for the agency. You're in those days. Like the brass wouldn't go to the ships. Like Captain Mann occasionally went to the ship. He was the owner of the company. Lakehead Shipping is a port agency who offers services to ship owners and charterers in terms of paying their bills in the port, making sure that both the charterer and the owner know the parameters of the contract or the charter party. So we, as a port agent is, I gave you this analogy before, it's you got a drink, you got different ingredients in your drink, then you have the port agent, who's the swizzle stick. So the port agent makes sure everything goes well. Any burst, I think we'll be okay for it.
Yeah.
Okay, so where was I? Okay.
You were talking about the swizzle stick.
Yeah, the swizzle stick, the port agent. The port agent, well, that's a euphemism, let's face it. But it's not far from the truth, because that's what a port agent does. He makes sure that everything is there that the ship needs to run to operate well. And a ship's purpose is to load their cargo or discharge its cargo as quickly as it can and be on the move. Sitting at an elevator or in a facility just doesn't make any money. The ship owner has to have that ship move. It's got to be moving. So as a port agent, you expedite the operations of that ship. Loading operations, what a port agent does, he liaises with the Grain Port Authority, which is still Canadian Ports Clearance Association. They're the pivots. And that's the first thing I learned in the grain business years ago when I first started. Be mindful of Lake Shippers Clearance Association. Lake Shippers Clearance Association are going to be your savior or they're going to be your nemesis. You've got to be on good terms with them at all times, because they assign the berths for you. They tell you what cargo you're getting in the elevator. They are the de facto people that are giving you these orders, so that you know where to put that ship, how long it's going to take. So you're really working with Lake Shippers Clearance Association, which is, as you know, turned into Canadian Ports Clearance, which is on the verge of distinction, unfortunately, and that's a source of a lot of consternation with a lot of people in the shipping business, in the grain business.
Since you've brought it up that they're going to be extinct, they've just sent out a note saying, I believe, August 31st of this year, they will no longer be operating.
Correct.
So in their absence, and in the absence of anything taking its place, what goes wrong?
Well, what I think is going to happen, a lot of these big grain companies, like Viterra, Richardson, Cargill, in that order in particular, will probably dictate to the other users as to where they're, as to what ships are going first, because they're the big guy. They're the big guy on the block. And by virtue of their behemoth size, they are going to not bully, but they're going to tell you, they're going to tell ships, well, no, I not first come first serve anymore. I've got 10,000 tons of number 2 amber durum that I got to move. Even though that ship was first, whatever, and it's going to have to wait, I got to move this. So they're going to be the people that are dictating where these ships are going to go. It's going to be a bit strange.
Can you explain why the Canadian Port Authority is disbanding? The clearance is disbanding.
Well, the Canadian Wheat Board is one of their big customers, and Canadian Ports, their executive have rationalized that if the Canadian Wheat Board isn't there, because the Canadian Wheat Board they're the big players on the block, and if they're not going to be there, then Canadian Ports, the reason for their existence is compromised. So there's no reason, according to their rationale, that they've had 11 staff across the country. Wheat Board goes, they have no role to play. So but you know what? There's a lot that could happen from now till August 31st. This could change. I mean, we don't know. A lot of people think it's writing on the wall, but there might be somebody that the elevator, that the big grain companies appoint to take over that position as a controller. as a coordinator. This is an opportunity for somebody or an organization to step in that role. Because we still have 8 elevators active in the port, and you still have to coordinate where that ship is going to go, and really knowing where the grain is and communicating to the captains. That's what they do. Roy, who's a one-man show here, Roy Ward, which I hope you have an opportunity to interview, along with Dan O'Connor. These are the guys who work with the captains direct. It's hands-on.
Mm. Yeah.
So they advise the ship where to go and what to do, how much they're going to take. With no control, with one elevator, with one grain company like Viterra says, okay, they're going to have to set up communications with the Laker owners, which, I mean, they have, but it's not as close as what Lake Shippers or Canadian Ports have developed over all these years. I mean, they know these captains like their relatives. I mean, and they know what to expect. It might be chaotic for a bit, but with something you think might go down as a poor decision, might just come up smelling roses. You don't know until that dynamic really takes hold.
Now, from your perspective, though, as a ship's agent,
yes,
what will that mean?
Well,
for you?
Heretofore, and it'll continue up until August. What my responsibility is for the ship owner in the ship charter as the representative of the ship. When I get the appointment from my principal, either in Europe or Montreal, normally it's from Montreal. They represent a lot of the ship owners. They would say, "Okay, Harib, we've got a ship for you. We've got the motor vessel Federal Hudson," and they say, "Okay, we'd like you to operate it for us. We'd like you to be the port agent for it." It's first thing you say is, "Well, when is it due?" Was the ETA. You establish that communication, and then they say, "Well, we'll keep you posted." So you take the reins right there. Then that's when you get the permission from the owner to let Canadian Ports know, which is a public entity, because some ship owners don't want, or some charters don't want, to let Canadian Ports know because of other competitors like Richardson's, or they don't want Richardson's or Cargill to know there's a ship in place, because they're trading. I mean, it's a big grain business is huge, huge trading dynamic. So sometimes they want to keep it really, really close to the chest up until maybe 3 or 4 days before the ship arrives, which is a bit of a problem for Canadian Ports, because they want as much lead time as possible so that they could have everything coordinated, because there's other ships. So the sooner, as far as I'm concerned, the sooner you give the ETA of the ship to Canadian Ports, they put it in the lineup, and like it heretofore, it's first comes first serve for Canadian Ports, and that's the way they played this game up until about 4 years ago when the big guys started to say, "Hey, that's not in our best interest. We're the big guys here. We want that ship in there right now, or we want it." So, it's sort of usurped Canadian Ports thing. It's been frustrating for them, but they've tried to keep a hold on it, the reins on it. But just to get back, once you put the ship in the lineup, officially, Canadian Ports starts working with Winnipeg, who are working with the Wheat Port. We would daily give updates on when the ship is here, what's going on, what the ship could load, give them a stow plan. We are always feeding them information so they could give us they could give us the timing that we need to make sure the ship operates as expeditiously as it can. We don't want to be waiting out at anchor for 3 days, because even minute delays, minutes add up to hours, hours add up to more hours, and a ship is worth, it could be worth anywhere up to $2,000 a day, $2,000 an hour. Some ships are worth, you know, $16,000, $17,000 a day, if you extrapolate that. So timing is important. That's where Canadian ports really play the game very fair for ship owners and charterers. But sometimes the charterers are saying to themselves, oh, we could do this all ourselves. We're big enough to do that. So it's going to be a bit of a chore. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be a new thing.
Just, I understand that my technical assistant here would like to ask questions,
okay,
which is great, but I'll introduce him so that the listener knows the voice. This is Ron Perozzo. He calls himself the technical assistant
in
training.
Okay, the IT guy.
I'm just curious, on the ships coming up, Salties would apparently be coming up with a load and then taking back something?
Not necessarily, Ron. Saltwater ships normally would come into the seaway with steel cargo, traditionally steel cargo, and they would discharge that at Cleveland or Detroit or Chicago for the steel mills. Of course, when the car industry was really revved up, I mean, there was a lot of steel coming in. So it was steel coming in, grain going back. They would discharge the steel in either Cleveland, or Toledo, Chicago, Milwaukee. It's like a milk run, you know, steel coils, steel pipe, steel for the car industry, right? Or other applications as well, but normally for the car industry. And then they would come up to the grain ports of Thunder Bay or Duluth, our nemesis. And they would pick up grain, and they would haul that grain back, either direct to discharge ports overseas or to a St. Lawrence River port where they would top off. Because you have a restriction here, the side of the Welland Canal, you cannot exceed 8 meters because of the restrictions in the lock system there. So you've got ships that could load hypothetically 35,000 tons if there was enough water to get through. So, but ships do top off in the St. Lawrence to get their appropriate summer dead or summer lift.
And what about Lakers? Are they coming up empty, or do they?
Lakers are moving up here. There's a system of coal shipments here. They're coming back and forth. You have a great you had a great year in lake traffic this year. You had a lot of movement of wheat board ships. They would come here, load, go to Baie-Comeau, Port Cartier, and come back empty, and they would do this as a regular trip. I think this year there must have been 350 Lakers. I'm not sure. I don't have the statistics, but of course, as you know, Ron, Lakers are the biggest networking of grain shipments here. I think we shipped 6.5 million tons of grain this year, and out of that was probably 85% were Laker shipments. So let's say 5.8 million tons, and the rest was saltwater traffic.
We got off track a little bit, mm-hmm. And I'd like to go back to your early days as the clerk,
mm-hmm.
with the
Lakehead Shipping
Company.
Limited. Started by Roland Mann, Captain Mann.
And where was he from originally?
Captain Mann was born in Ireland, and he joined the Navy when he was a young man. War broke out, and he saw his duties in the Far East, and he rose in ranks to officer, and he became a captain. And a delightful man, a delightful man. He was such a gentleman. I remember the first time I met him. He was a big, tall guy, and he had this impressive, even though he was born in Ireland, he didn't have this Irish accent. He had a typical English accent, very impressive. And anyway, he left the English Navy, and he started in the he became a captain in the Merchant Marine, and I think in the early 1950s he took a job ashore. When you take a job ashore, you work for an agency, or you become a advisor, or somebody working in charter parties or contracts and marketing and all that stuff. But he got a job, and he met a woman from Norway. He traveled all over the world, and he met this really nice lady from Norway. They got married, and they decided to come to Canada, because that's where it was. A lot of immigrants in the early 50s were coming to Canada, a lot of English, a lot of people from the UK. And he took a job in Hamilton, I think it was 1955, 56, before the Seaway was completed. It was just starting. So he saw a lot of things that were, there was a good future for the shipping business. And he wanted eventually to start a business. Anyway, he worked for this people. It was Hamilton Shipping. He worked there for 3 or 4 years, and then in 1959, his boss had the idea that, well, you know, the Seaway's going up to all the way to the head of the Great Lakes, where all these elevators are. I mean, ocean ships are going to start coming in, and we need a man up there. So he sent Captain Mann, Roly Mann, on a sort of a fact-finding trip up here in 1959. Actually, I'm doing a story about him. He's going to be one of my chapters in the next Movers and Mavericks book. I'll be looking forward to writing about him. But he came up here, and first thing he discovered, there was no... there was nobody that was doing anything about the possibility of receiving ocean ships. He went to people like Patterson, and Patterson didn't want to have anything to do with them, because there was competition. I mean, it was Lakers. They didn't want ocean ships up here. There's no way. So he met up with some brick walls, and he went to Lake Shippers, and it was a notorious guy there. His name was Hendel. I'm sure that story, Hendel, in your research will come up. This fellow ran Lake Shippers like Napoleon, or like Joseph Stalin, actually. So he didn't want to have anything to do with ocean ships either. But, you know, Roland Mann, Captain Mann, being a very persistent fellow, and he knew how to talk to people, and he realized the potential here. And of course, you had two ports in those days. You had Fort William and Port Arthur, two port authorities. So in any event, he went back to report to his the owner of Hamilton Shipping, and he reported, he gave a pretty good picture of, well, you know, this is a good place to start an international shipping business agency as a port agent. And he said, yeah, okay, you head back there and you start it. So he came back, and one of the first people he met was an accountant named Mr. Chernick, John Chernick. God bless him, he's still alive, 93 years old. And first thing he did, open up an account with him, or had him to open up the accounting part of the business. And he got started with, he took a little office on top of where Agnew Surpass Shoe Store was on the corner of May and Victoria. That's started in 1959. And he had his first ship here in May of that year. And there was no linesman, there was no pilotage. So he started the Pilotage Association, he started the linesmen. He persuaded the tugs, who didn't want to have anything to do with the ocean ships, to start, because he needed towage. These ships had to be pushed and towed and shifted. So he managed to convince Oscar, or Mr. Stiff, who owned the Red Tugs, to be his tug people. And of course they arranged for tariffs and what to charge and all that. So he started that. He started his shipping company. There was another fellow, his competitor here too, Sandy Henderson. He ran Henderson Cartage on Simpson Street. And he was his competitor. Sandy Henderson, there's a young Sandy Henderson, we still have young Sandy Henderson, he's 70 years old now, so he's not that young. But his father started the business. But they're always, I remember when I started the business, Captain Mann was always saying, well, don't let Sandy Henderson know anything about our business. Or, you know, it was very tight. They held everything tight because they were so ardent competitors.
So I'm going to send you back to 1975 when you started.
Okay.
So you knew, I would think, not much about shipping or ships.
No.
So when you think about when you were starting, if you can, put mm-hmm. yourself back, say, on your first week on the job.
Okay. I was
amazed. What surprised you?
Well, I was amazed. Actually, the interview to get the job was amazing, too, because I remember a fellow, his name was Charlie Umferson. He was the operations manager of Lakehead Shipping. Captain Mann hired him in the mid-60s. And he knew nothing about shipping. He was but he learned. He learned quite well, very well. And he was a very effective operations manager. He happened to, he was a appliance salesman at Gary's. My father, bought his first stove off Charlie from Gary's. So when I went in for the interview for the water clerk job, I don't know, I had a water clerk. Water clerk meant the bathroom attendant as far as I knew. I didn't know. So he described the job and he says, by the way, your dad, his name is John? I said, yeah, that's my father. He said, oh yeah, I sold him his first stove back in 1954. What a great guy. I said, yeah, he's my father, he's a great guy. So that, I think, got me in the door. Because he really enjoyed my father's company. And Charlie knew my grandfather too. Because I think they tilted a few drinks during their time. So it all came to sort of name recognition. And he knew, and of course, he knew, he asked me, do you speak any languages? I said, yeah, I speak Ukrainian. I said, I speak Spanish too. I learned how to speak Spanish because I spent all this time in South America, so I was able to speak that language. And he thought it would be an asset because we had a lot of Russian ships coming in the mid-70s. There was a huge trade with Russia in rye. We haven't shipped rye out of this port, the grain rye, for I don't know how many years. But in the 70s, we used to have a lot of Soviet ships come in. And Ukrainian being close to Russian, he thought it may be an asset. But the first thing he asked me when I got into the interview, he said to me, "Hey, you afraid of heights?" I says, "No." "You smoke cigarettes?" "Yeah." I mean, while he's smoking, his export A is swirling all over the place. Oh, he said, "Okay, that's good." I don't know why. But he figured I'd bring him cigarettes now and again, but I don't know. Anyway, he said, "Okay, I'll call you in a couple of days," because he had a few people to interview. Then he called me. He said, "Okay, kid, you're hired. Be here May the 1st. And I remember the first day I got there, and he said, "Okay, we've got a ship. We've got a Greek ship at Cargill Elevator. I'm going to take you there. We're going to show you what we do, what I do. And then I'm just going to hand it over to you next week. You're going to be doing what I'm showing you to do. But if you've got any questions after, you don't hesitate. You ask." And I said, "Okay." And he had this huge Buick, 1975. He had a brand new car every year, this guy. So I'm like, "Holy smokes, this guy. You know, this is good money at this game, right?" Even the money that I started with was pretty good at that time. It was more than what a laborer would make at Great Lakes. So it was sort of a...
So what was that?
It was, at that time, I think they gave me $640 a month. 1975, which was reasonable, I guess. When I worked as a camp clerk at 601, a couple of years before that, I was making considerably less. But anyway, I thought it was good. It was good money. And then I sort of was... and Charlie looked prosperous, you know, nice car. And I said, "Oh, gee, it's a bit of I had my own office, young kid. Well, I was 26, but and it was, I thought it was prestigious. It was a prestigious job. You get to meet all these people. Anyway, we went to Cargill. That was the first ship I had. It was a Greek ship, and went on board. I was on it. Ocean ship before that, when I was selling newspapers, so I knew what to expect in a way. The ships that I was on were rather ill-capped, I remember, but this one was really, I was quite impressed. It was clean, and captain was really polite. He welcomed us into his boardroom. And in those days, ships that were built in the early 70s, mid 70s, they were really impressive. The captain really had a great office, a lot of wood, a huge desk, a nice board table, and very hospitable. He'd snap his fingers, and a steward would come and offer you coffee. We'd say, "American coffee or Greek coffee?" I didn't know what Greek coffee was. And I said, "Okay, Greek coffee." And Greek coffee comes in a little cup, sweet. And he says, "Well, you want a little bit of ouzo with that?" You know, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. Charlie says, yeah, we'll have some ouzo. Okay. I said, "Okay." And I was sort of in glee, you know. What are we doing? We're doing business. We're having a cup of coffee. We're on a ship, a foreign ship. This is amazing. Surroundings are great. Captains are good. And we're drinking coffee, and I'm having a little ouzo. So Charlie cleared the ship, and he was very cautious with me. And and that was my first experience. It was at Cargill Elevator. And then that year, the second ship, I was on my own. It's called the Welsh Voyageur. We had ships from all over the place.
Where would the ships come from? Or where have they come from?
Well,
they
would come from Greece. In those days, the merchant, the Greek merchant marine was just, were the top people in the world. Onassis, there were Olympic ships. Onassis had a fleet of ships. Russian ships, Soviet Union ships. They were kind of strange because every Russian ship or a Soviet Union type country, like Bulgaria, would have a commissar on board. So he would, every time you'd go on a ship, it was the captain and this guy who wouldn't introduce himself. He'd be sitting there with the captain. And I remember one time asking the captain after this guy had to go someplace outside the cabin. I said, excuse me, captain. And I was very polite. I said, excuse me, but I really don't want to interfere here, but this fellow here really didn't introduce himself. I'd like to, you know, say hello. And he says, well, no, he's the commissar. You don't talk to the commissar. I said, okay, the commissar. Of course, the commissar is the political boss. He is telling the captain politically what to do on the ship. If you've got some dignitaries on the ship who want to offer a plaque to the ship, captain asks the commissar. Commissar gives him the permission, and commissar is. I was amazed the power he had, because every time the captain had different people at the table, he would measure what he would be saying by sort of glancing over to the commissar. He'd be looking at him like this, you know, and then continuing. And if the commissar was smiling, then he knew he was on the right track. But that was always, that was kind of strange, different. And we used to have Cuban ships come up here with the same type of situation. But they were more stringent. Like, they would tell the captain, sit down or stand up. They were pretty sharp. I mean, sharp in terms of negative. So that was different. We had ships from England. Oh, ships from England. They used to bring in the greatest beer you could imagine. And of course, I'm in my late 20s. And when you're a kid, beer was a great thing to be a part of. In those days, they used to give you beer. You used to take beer off the ships. I remember Charlie saying to me, you get caught with a case of beer, you're going to be in big trouble. But I was pretty ingenious. I used to get one of the guys to carry it off for me. So I measured my season by the number of cases I got. I remember one season I got 86 cases of beer. My basement was stacked with every imaginable beer from around the world. Brazil, Argentina. And I always used to amaze my friends. They'd say to him, hey, Willie, what do you got today? What would you like? Chinese beer? You want some Russian beer? And I used to have this stash of beer.
So were Chinese ships coming in here?
Ships were here, yeah. They used to come in here. But not till the mid-80s. Early 80s, mid-80s. But in the 70s, mainly, there were the Russians, or the Soviets, with the Soviet flag, and I always remember those. The Greeks, the English, Bolton Line, I remember. I remember this one Captain William Williams. This guy, and they called him Captain Johnny Walker, and for good reason. I met him the first time. They came into Kiefer Terminal. They had to clean the holds because the bugmen went out at anchor. And the bugmen in those days were the Department of Agriculture, like Vic Bell and those guys. They would inspect the ship for cleanliness, for bug infestation, for rust. Anyway, the ship was at anchor. We went on board, and I met Captain Williams, and he was, I mean, he was 10 sheets to the wind, big time. And what really amazed me with those ships, in those days you had crews of 45, 48. And on the English ships in particular, they all looked like pirates. The bosun had maybe two fingers missing on one hand, little fingers over, no finger there. And they wore bandanas and smoked, and, you know, smoked like crazy. And people would be walking around limps. I mean, it was atrocious. English ships, especially the bosun, and the swearing. Oh my God! Every flippin' second word was flip this, flap that. It was just. I picked up a repertoire like you wouldn't believe. But I was just amazed over this guy, Captain Williams, and he's long gone now. But I remember inviting me after the ship came into the Kiefer terminal, and we had cleaning gangs in those days. The cleaning gangs would go in there, and these long stage ladders, and they would chip, or they would spray for bugs, whatever. But I remember as the port agent, as the representative, you were the guy who was the representative, and everybody looked up to you. Really, you were greeted at the gangway like a very important person, and I liked that. So I recognized that there was a lot of perks in this job.
You mentioned one.
Yes, that was one, and of course they would they would give you cigarettes and things like this, and you were able to sit with them and discuss politics, world politics, one on one, because they've been all over the world, and you get this unique perspective of what's happening, which was really, for me, as a political, I studied political science in school too, and I really enjoy politics, so I like world politics. And I really peppered these guys with questions, and we used to drink on board. I remember Charlie, my boss, it was not uncommon to get on the ship at noon for lunch and have three or four scotch or beer, and go back to the office and do your work. I mean, it was a culture in itself, drinking and doing that sort of stuff, that type of behavior. And this captain, I mean, he wasn't shy in showing that he could drink. And boy, did he drink! But I soon recognized you could get into trouble with this sort of stuff. I mean that type of high life wasn't something that I really wanted to get caught with. So, but there were times on ships, there, you know, you would have your session with the captain, and you'd be talking, and you'd be there for an hour, and all of a sudden it's 7 hours, because you'd have your libations and the steward. And the stewards in those days, they were stewards. They were dressed really nice, tunics, and you had a lot of crew to work with. Like today, on an ocean ship, if you've got 18 crew, you're lucky. And now too, you've got smaller ships. You've got less crew. You've got these niche type ships that come in. But in those days, you had a lot of crew, and Indian ships used to come up here too with huge 55, 60 crew, and they were kind of very, very different. Because the culture was so different and the food was so unique, I love Indian food because of that experience. in those days. They and talk about you sit at a captain's table on an Indian ship. You don't not only had one steward, you had about four, and each would come in with a different curry. And very polite, they'd stand back, and you're finished something, they'd come right really quickly, and they would treat you like you're the Maharaja or something. So they really treated you well. So that was quite different.
Was there any shipping out of Africa or South America?
Yes, there was. There was African ships that used to come up here, but usually for bagged cargo. They would come here and load bagged cargo, and some would come up here with cargo of cocoa or that sort of stuff, and they would discharge it either at the shed six in the Cam River, or they come to the Keefer Terminal, and those ships were kind of different because in those days you didn't see a black man, you hardly. And you had a whole ship with black men. It was kind of, it was different. It was sort of, something you didn't see. But there was there wasn't any racism involved. Maybe there was some longshoreman who would say something stupid or whatever. But
South America?
South America, there were Colombian ships that came up here to load grain, barley. They would come up here to, I remember in the 80s, mid-80s, ships would come, they'd fly the Colombian, they would be registered in Barranquilla or Cartagena, and they'd come up. And these ships were chartered by millers, and the miller would meet the ship here. He would travel and meet the ship here. And depending on the master's performance, going up the seaway, whatever, and he'd personally give the master some sort of monetary bonus, always on the sly, always never to let the crew know. These millers looked like they were, they wielded a lot of power, and so they would buy the grain direct. They would buy they'd hand over the check here, because Captain Manny used to deal with that, and they'd pay for the grain, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So that was the extent of the South American traffic.
So they would, the millers would go to
the millers
Richardson's
would,
or Colville?
Yeah, the millers would set up, would probably do a trip into, come up to North America or various places, and go to Winnipeg because they knew they could get a good deal there. They would do their research and they would go to Richardson's or they would go to Cargill and say, hey, we need some, or Canada Malting, we need some malting barley. I need 12,000 tons. I have a ship in position for this particular date, time frame. And they would make that arrangement, that deal. And they would come up. They would make sure the ship is here in time. They would time it accordingly. And they would do that. Also, there's South Africa too. We used to have a lot of ships coming that were chartered by breweries in South Africa coming in to take malting barley for their breweries down there. South Africa, as you know, really they have per capita a lot of breweries, a lot of beer production, and the brewmasters used to come and examine the cargo as it was being loaded. They'd really be hovering over the inspection staff, and these brewmasters are really fastidious. I mean, they're real. And they'd come in and make sure. And they were sort of a pain in the butt for a lot of the inspectors because they were just, you know, they're over there, you're just looking over them, making sure, and you know, going into the ship and making sure, or not going, making sure that what's coming out of the spout is what they bought. And yeah, they were always very clever, clever people.
How's our time? That was then, and what about now?
Okay.
Okay. You've been talking to us about what it was like in the earlier days of your career related to the ships that were coming in, the what the crews were like, what your interaction with them was, where they were coming from. So if we skip to present day then, what has changed?
Well, what has changed is, as I mentioned before, crews have become smaller. Captains have become more responsible to the owners. In the 1970s, early 80s, masters were true masters. Over the course of the last 20 years, you could see an evolution where ship owners or operators want to have control. And there's a lot of complaints by masters that I hear today that, well, 30 years ago it was different. The master was really the master. He was in control of the ship. You didn't have the instant communication that you have today. Ship owner could get on the line, or you could, through email, through that those communication methods, you could virtually operate the ship from your office in Copenhagen, much to the chagrin of ship masters. You have a lot of ship masters who, if they had to retrace their lives, some would say, no, I wouldn't choose the field if I knew what was happening today. You see a lot of masters today that are planning their retirement a lot earlier, who want to leave the business because they know and they realize that the ship owner is really pulling the strings. So they're like a marionette in a way. Like, I mean, it's still a very dignified profession, and it's very respectful, but you could see where a fellow who has always wanted to be shipmaster, and he finds out that he is becoming the driver of the ship. It's demoralizing for a fellow like that who had the passion to become a mariner, true mariner. So you could see ship personnel are difficult to get. I mean, I think there's going to be a crisis one day in the international shipping business, where qualified masters will not be that abundant as they once were, because of the, you know, I mean, it's still a very respected profession, very different type of profession. You're away from home 4 months. Like in the 70s, you're away for 7-8 months. It's become a little bit more relaxed now. You're on for 3 months, off for 3 months. Some ship owners, 2 months, just to keep it attractive, off for two, on for two. So you are, it's changing. It has really changed.
What about the difference in experience or training over the time? I assume you went through the fellows who came, who were, as you say, merchant marine.
Well, a lot of these people, a lot of young men who studied maritime trade went to different levels of school. They became a third, in those days, a fourth mate, a third mate, second mate. So you had these different layers. Now you're seeing masters who are 29 years old who've skipped all that stuff. They're just fast-tracking these young men into those positions. Of course, in those days, you know, in the 70s, you had you had to have the skills to be a real mariner. Today, ships are automated. They're controlled, satellite. I mean, you could be on automatic pilot with some of these ships and have one guy on the bridge. I mean, it's changed. The technology has changed the whole business. And again, I have to emphasize, ship owners and operators have become the real masters. It's flipped around.
The welcome committee you had, the lunches, the still have cases of beer in your basement?
No.
Now, so what caused that? When did that change and what caused that?
Fright. well, that changed because a lot of these ships don't have, a lot of them don't have liquor on board anymore. Has changed. There are some that still have, and they're kept in a bonded store, and I guess the culture has changed because you don't want to, you know, in those days, I guess if you got caught drinking and driving, the conditions would be different and what the repercussions would be. So that's sort of changed that whole culture too. And the captain's really mindful about onboard drinking because you've got a big sign on his, it's just a international rule, International Maritime Organization rule, no drinking, no drugs, big, you know, big signs. And in particular, when you're trading in the United States, you've got Coast Guard who come in and check on drinking. They do blood tests. So that's changed. When ships are in port, of course the captain is that's his home, and if he wants to have a drink with the agent or his guest, that's okay. But you don't see a inebriated master anymore, like you did in the old days. There was times where you'd say, "Oh my God," but that whole culture has disappeared.
What about the port clearances? I remember reading stories about being able to clear in Singapore before you dock with the electronic communication and stuff like that.
No. You have to clear the ship in the port that you're arriving from. It doesn't matter. You have an international ship. You've got to clear that ship in with your local customs. And that's part of the agent's job. First thing he does is clear the ship in. You have the clearance from, say, the ship. Very seldom a ship would be traveling from, say, Singapore. That's about 54 days all the way through the seaway without stopping someplace. First of all, you have to stop at Montreal for a seaway inspection. But the last official port of your overseas trip, that document has to be presented to the port that you're arriving at, like Thunder Bay. Say a ship is coming in from, we have a ship coming in from, China. Sometimes you have project cargo and they're at sea for 49, 50 days. Well, you have, it's so high tech now, they fax you, or not fax you, they email you the document, you print it, And everything's done by, like in the old days, it was physical. You had to go to the customs and knock on the door, bang on the door, and present your customs paper physically. Today it's not, you fax it or you email it. And documentation is a lot easier. It's all done through email or text stuff. Like, for example, another very important function of an agent or a ship the master through the port agent is to supply a document called the Notice of Readiness. The Notice of Readiness is a document that has the ship's name and its Notice of Readiness and it's stamped or signed normally by the captain with the ship stamp, or if he's not available, the agent could do that. So that Notice of Readiness in the old days has to be presented to Canadian ports who represent the shipper. It just shows that the ship is ready to load in all respects. And it has to be accompanied by the certificates that you need to get a certificate of fitness to load from the Port Warden Transport Canada. They give you that certificate, and Canadian Food Inspection Agency give you another certificate. So you need those two certificates when you're loading grain on ocean ships. Lakers, you don't need that. But that's a different dynamic in the grain business for ocean ships.
With the two certificates, what is the difference at the port?
Well, it just shows that, you see, the ship has to prove that the ship is clean in all respects. That's clean of any residues, clean of any insect infestation. That's where the CFIA comes in. Or in those days, it was called Agriculture Canada. They're the euphemistically called the bug man, right? That's the first part of the equation. You get that. Then the Transport Canada, a part of the grain rules for North America, is that the ship has to prove that it is that the integrity of the stability of the ship is within the parameters of Transport Canada rules. There's a stability calculation that has to be presented. It's a very complicated calculation. What you're doing what the ship is doing is proving to the Transport Canada that if you've got some empty compartments here, you got grain here, it's not going to capsize the ship. So your stability issue has to be in check. So the port warden diligently goes through the stability. Today, very, very diligent. In the old days, you'd get a port warden. We'd have guys. In the old days, they'd look at it. Okay, yeah, that's good, Captain. We'll have another drink. We had a notorious guy, God bless him, here, and part of the port warden's duty is to go into the holds, as the CFIA does, and look into the behind the pipe casings and in the different areas of the hold to examine it. And one of the duties of the port warden, Transport Canada, is to make sure the holds, the frames in the ship hold, some of them still have frames, there are the integrity, there's no cracks and whatever. Well, this port warden, he'd look over the side and say, well, that's great, that's good. And he'd make a beeline back up to the ship, up to the cabin where I was. And I'd say, yeah, how's it going? Good, everything good? Yeah, no problem. And it was notorious this way. And good thing, there was not one ship under his, as he signed anything, ever went down or had a problem. But that all changed. About 20 years ago when the ship called the Flame went down. The Flame? I forget the name. Anyway, it went down in the St. Lawrence and stability was an issue they discovered, and she loaded grain and she went down. She sank. It was a big scandal. So it sort of hyped up the Transport Canada and to say, hey, these port wardens better be doing their jobs. And it got to be a real chore because they went through every numeral. I mean, crisscross this, double check. You know, normally, and when I started this business, a stability calculation inspection would be, say, an hour and a half. Well, today it's about three and a half hours, and it's really much to the consternation of a lot of ship owners, because as I mentioned, time is money. So anyway,